Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% Lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I was a young beat reporter going to work at a newspaper in the Midwest, and I had just finished covering high school basketball. And Pete Newell Jr. was the high school coach at Santa Cruz High School. Pete Newell Jr. said, "Oh, where are you going to cover?" I said, "I'm going to cover Indiana basketball. Bobby Knight's the coach." And his eyes just lit up, and he said, "Oh, my dad mentored Bobby." And he gave me a book. He gave me John Feinstein's Season on the Brink, and he said, "Read this." Now, I'd already read it, but I read it again on the plane ride out to the Midwest as I'm going to cover Indiana basketball 1998-1999. It was before the beginning of the end of Bobby Knight. But man, was it a wild story and a great story that John Feinstein told all those years ago. He has gone on to write several books. The Legend Club, The First Majors, Season on the Brink, Backfield Boys, A Good Walk Spoiled. And he's got a new book out, The Ancient Eight. And it might be just what we need with college football realignment kind of spoiling things. And maybe we need to reach back to where what college football is supposed to be. He's written about the Ivy League in college football. It's called The Ancient Eight. John Feinstein joining us now. How are you? Having a little phone problem. We will get John Feinstein queued up here momentarily, but we do not have him. I'll leave it to you, Stephen. There he is, John Feinstein. I had such a great intro, and then we just face planted there. How are you, John?
I'm very well, John. Especially after I heard that intro, it was very kind, and I hear the little bell when you're being brought on, and then I was gone, and I'm sure both my wives wish they could have done that.
I just, in that moment, I could hear Bobby Knight throwing his clipboard, or stomping,
Or like saying, good move, getting rid of him.
Before we get into the new book, I know it probably comes up all the time, but is sure. Season on the Brink the one you get asked about still?
Yes. Certainly for the longest time, because it's my oldest book dating back to 1986, and it was my first book, and it did launch me as an author. This is my 50th book, believe it or not.
Wow.
35 nonfiction, 15 fiction. I get asked about Bob all the time, and we certainly had an up and down relationship, but fortunately for me, he was willing to give me the access he did for Season on the Brink. And no matter what anybody says about him, no matter what he has said about me years ago, I will always be grateful to him for that.
And I think, I talked about this off the top of the show, that we often try to simplify people into, easy to digest narratives but life and people are often very complex. And I found him that way.
Right.
There were some really redeeming parts of what he did, like his players coming back and sitting in Letterman's jackets and the loyalty he had and, the fact that he'd jump into a car with, like, Kirk Haston and, Haston's parents, one of his parents had died that season and he drove that kid through the night back home. And then you see him at his worst, too, right, where he walks into a news conference and he says, "Anybody got a question?" And you look up and he's walking out. Like, it's just,
yep.
There was that range with him.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you couldn't put Bob into a box in terms of analyzing who he was. And that's why he was such a fascinating figure. And I think that's why so many people were fascinated by the book, because of who he was. And I can honestly say I saw all those sides of him. I saw him at his very best, as I said, when he gave me the access to the book that he did. And he never, John, backed away from it throughout that season, even at the worst possible moments for him and the team. And I saw him at his worst. When he said things about me that I knew weren't true and that I'm sure he knew weren't true. And I think the best example, though, is his relationship with Mike Krzyzewski. When Mike Krzyzewski's father died when he was a junior at Army, Knight left his team for 2 days to go to Chicago and be with him and with his mom and with his brother. And then when Krzyzewski became more successful than him, he turned on him. And said things about him that, again, he knew weren't true and Mike knew weren't true. So you're 100% right in your analysis.
John, I went from covering Knight to covering Jerry Tarkanian the next year. And that swing of the pendulum was whiplash. But
yes, 180 degrees.
I look at those guys, and Tark was doing NIL before it was fashionable. How do you think Knight would have done in this era?
Probably not well. He probably would have been very annoyed at the idea of bidding for players. I remember talking to him about coaching in the NBA, and he said, I never would have succeeded in the NBA because if I walked into the locker room at halftime and I saw a guy making millions of dollars with 2 points and two rebounds, I wouldn't be able to handle it. Well, how would he have been able to handle that with college kids? I completely agree with you, and it's funny what you said about Tark and NILs. I love Tark, but somebody asked me recently how I thought Rick Pitino would do at St. John's. And I said, he'll do very well because all the rules he used to break don't exist anymore.
I love it. So you do Season on the Brink is book one. Does it open the door for you to kind of make the transition eventually away from being an everyday newspaper guy into saying, I'm going to take these deeper long form dives? Or what are you thinking after that book? Because it eventually leads you to today in this new book.
Yeah, well, I've never given up newspapers because I love them. And I still write for The Washington Post and consider myself very fortunate to still be doing that. But your point is well taken. Season on the Brink opened up doors for me to do essentially what I wanted to do as an author. I had agents and publishers say to me, why would you write a book about Army Navy? And I said, because I want to. And I was able to do it, and the book was a bestseller. And this book was basically set up, the Ancient Eight that we're going to talk about, by a book I wrote 20-odd years ago on Patriot League basketball called The Last Amateurs. And my agent and my number one advisor, Bob Woodward, the great Bob Woodward, said, you can't do a book on that. Nobody's going to buy it. Nobody's heard of any of those kids. And they were both right. Nobody had heard of any of those kids. And I wrote the book, and what I found, which I'd found doing Army-Navy, is that you don't have to be rich and famous to have a story to tell. In fact, sometimes those who aren't rich and famous have great stories to tell. And that also became, The Last Amateurs also became a bestseller. And I had the same hopes for this book because the kids I'm writing about here are smart, interesting kids with stories to tell. And that's why I enjoy doing the book so much.
Do you find the access when you do a book like this on the Ivy League? And I'm fascinated by this because of the era we're in and the Ivy League sort of maybe being one of the last places where real college football still exists. But do you find that the access is an advantage to you because you're not dealing with Coach Prime and having to get through several layers of his people to get access and interviews?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I had complete access throughout the season during practices and games and interviewing kids and being in the locker rooms during games. And it made it fun to be around and to see behind the scenes. And I think that's one of the things I've tried to do throughout my writing career. I mean, going back to Season on the Brink, as I said, when Knight gave me the access that he did. And I've always tried to take readers where they don't get to go. You know, that's what reporters are supposed to do. But as you point out, nowadays, it's so much harder for day-to-day reporters. I mean, when I was covering the University of Maryland 100 years ago, I just routinely went to practice every day. Nowadays, you need a court order to get into most college practices. But I didn't have to deal with that during the Ivy League book. And it also helped, and this may sound immodest, but most of those kids knew who I was. Now, in today's world, when you meet athletes, big-time, so-called big-time athletes, usually they won't have any idea who I am or who Bob Woodward is, for that matter. But all these Ivy League kids had read some of my books and knew who I was, and it almost got embarrassing when they kept thanking me throughout the season for doing the book. I was saying, no, thank you for giving me the time and the storytelling and your honesty.
This book, I mentioned kind of the throwback to college athletics. Do you come away from writing The Ancient Eight thinking that there is college football that still exists as we once know it? And I'm not really saying I don't believe players should get money, but just sort of the innocence and the purity of it all.
Yeah, no, and that's sort of what led me to the book in a way. I mean, my background growing up in New York, going to Ivy League football games was certainly part of it. But also in today's world, look, I went to Duke, and I followed the Duke basketball program since before Mike Krzyzewski got there. Believe it or not, there was basketball there before Mike Krzyzewski. And yet right now it's very hard for me to get emotional or psyched up about Duke basketball because I know, you know, Cooper Flagg's not going to be there next year. He's identified in every story as presumed number one NBA draft pick next June. Well, how do I get excited about a kid who's just kind of going through Duke because the rules say he has to, or any other kid at any other school who's going to be a one and done? But the Ivy League in football and basketball, they stay 4 years. They graduate. They are real students. I mean, I hear the term student athlete most of the time. I want to throw up because, you know, the kids, there's nothing wrong with being an athlete, as you say. There's nothing wrong with NILs. In fact, they're the right thing to do, especially in today's world. But when you're watching a game and they introduce a kid and they say, well, last year he played here, and the year before that he played there, and now he's here, that's college athletics? No, but the Ivy League in football and basketball, as I said, is college athletics. It's kids who are going to get degrees, who are going to stay 4 years. And the reason I titled the book The Ancient Eight is because the Ivy League will never realign. It'll never have 9 teams or 10 teams or 12 teams. It's always going to have the same 8 teams as it had when the league was first formed in 1956.
The book is called The Ancient Eight. It's college football's Ivy League and the game they play today. John Feinstein, our guest, author of the book. Take us inside one of the rivalries. And because I, you know, the Civil War here in Oregon is threatened by realignment. The Apple Cup has been threatened by realignment. I was at the Holy War. I covered that the other night, and I thought, gosh, maybe there's an example of one rivalry that's been helped by realignment. Okay, but take us to the Ivy League rivalries.
Well, they are ancient, literally. They date back to the 19th century. Princeton played in the first college football game in 1869 against Rutgers, which is not an Ivy League team, but Harvard and Yale, you know, which is the storied rivalry in the league among many, I would say, they date back to 1875, and it's called The Game, all caps, for a reason, because it was the game. They were playing for national championships. In fact, when you walk into Harvard Stadium, which was built in 1903, there are 8 national championship banners. The last one was in 1919, because they go back so far, and they were national powers until the league presidents decided that they didn't want to be national powers anymore. They wanted to be schools where academics came first and where football, basketball, and all sports came after that. And that was in 1956 when they formally became the Ivy League. They've been playing against each other, as I said, since the 19th century. But they formalized becoming the Ivy League, and they said, we're going to have academic standards. We're only going to play 9 games a season. Now they play 10. They play 10 straight Saturdays, and except for several Friday night games. They all play on Saturdays, 10 weeks in a row, no buys. The presidents, in my opinion, they're wrong, but they don't allow the champion of the league to take part in the FCS playoffs. I think that's a mistake. But I do think that in this era, when you talk about the Apple Cup being threatened, you talk about USC and UCLA being in the Big Ten, are you kidding me? You know, you talk about the fact that Missouri and Kansas don't play anymore, which has been one of the great rivalries through the years. But the Ivy League rivalries happen every year, the same week of the season, ending the Saturday before November, and then everybody goes home for Thanksgiving. And as you said, in this day and age, there's not very much of that left.
I am looking at it, and I remember during the pandemic, the Ivies kind of made the decision very early, hey, we're not playing, and the SEC right. and everybody else went on. How do they insulate that league? You got a real good feel for it in the book. How do those presidents sort of hold on to the values of, you know, of the last 150 years while in a world that doesn't look anything like that?
Yeah, it's because they've made a conscious decision to do that, and they've told their coaches, their athletic directors, whomever, you cannot recruit kids with 600 on the SATs. You can't bring kids in here and have them play 1 year here and another place another year, or turn pro after 3 years, which is the minimum for the NFL, as you know. And the coaches understand that this is when they take a job in the Ivy League, this is what they face. And the players understand that if you make the decision to go to the Ivy League, because obviously a lot of these kids are very good football players, they're all very good students, so they're recruited by plenty of non-Ivy League schools. And when they make the decision to go to the Ivy League, this is what it's going to be. You're going to have to keep your grades up. You're going to be expected to graduate. You're going to play 10 weeks in a row, and that's going to be it. And once they accept that, you know, like a lot of the players I talk to wish they could play in postseason, wish that the best team last year, excuse me, there was a three-way tie for the Ivy League title. Well, they don't bother to break the tie because no one's going to postseason. But a lot of those kids said, we'd like to show people how good we are. And, for example, Harvard last year, the fourth week of the season, played against Holy Cross, which had gone to the FCS semifinals the year before and was ranked fourth and was undefeated coming into play at Holy Cross, and Harvard won the game because they're good. And that's what happens when they do get opportunities frequently to play against other top FCS schools. I'm not saying they could compete with Oregon, for example, because right now nobody can. But all kidding aside, they are very competitive. There's usually and somewhere between 12 and 16 Ivy League players who are in the NFL. You know all about Ryan Fitzpatrick, who played 17 years in the NFL with 9 different teams. And you know about guys like Calvin Hill and Brian Dowling and arguably, to me, one of the greatest college football games ever played was the 1968 Harvard-Yale game when they were both undefeated. And Harvard scored 16 points in the last 42 seconds to tie the game at 29. And the Harvard Crimson the next day wrote the best headline, I think, in history, Harvard beat Yale 29-29. I still laugh every time I say that.
I love that. The Ancient Eight is the book. John Feinstein is with us. I won't keep you too much longer, but, you know, we talk about places to see games, and I'll tell people, hey, you got to go to Notre Dame and see a game there, or you got to go to Ohio State or Autzen Stadium. In the Ivy right. League, where's the place to go see a game if we're putting a bucket list together?
Well, you'd first want to go see Harvard-Yale, wherever it's played. It sells out every year. The Ivy League doesn't sell that many tickets. The average attendance is usually between 10 and 15,000. But Harvard-Yale sells out, whether it's in the Yale Bowl with 50,000 seats or in Harvard Stadium with 40,000 seats. They used to be bigger. They cut down the size of the stadiums when they renovated them through the years. But if you're asking me just the one stadium in the Ivy League to go see a game, this may show my bias because I grew up there, but I'd say Columbia. It's just it's right in the middle of New York City. You're up near the tip of Manhattan, and Broadway's a couple blocks from the campus, and the IRT subway runs to 215th Street, and then it's 3 blocks to walk to the Bakersfield complex. But once you get into Bakersfield, you feel like you're somewhere in the country because it's such a pretty stadium. So that I'm sure others would disagree with me. These stadiums are all old. There are no new stadiums in the Ivy League except for Princeton, where they tore down Princeton Stadium in 1999 and just completely rebuilt it. It is the nicest stadium in the Ivy League. But if I had a bucket list to only go to one, I was lucky to go to all 8 last year. I would go to Columbia.
The book is worth your time. Check it out. The Ancient Eight. John Feinstein is the author. Yeah, book number 50. How does that feel to you, 50 books?
Old. but very lucky. Very lucky. Yeah. And again, I go back to Bob Knight, who allowed me to write that first book and have the freedom I've had through the years. You know, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening are saying, the Ivy League, why do I care about a book about the Ivy League? Well, I hope if you read it, you'll come away caring about the people, because that's what I try to write about. I write about people who happen to be in sports, and the people in this book are just terrific.
I love that. I'll pick it up. I encourage people to pick it up as well. And I'll tell you this on the way out. You know, I remember covering an IU Temple game, and Knight beat John Chaney at the buzzer with a 3-pointer by AJ Guyton. And post game news conference, this won't surprise you, he sent out two freshmen that never played in the game to talk to the media. And we were just like, come on.
Yeah. Well, you know, they won a game the year I did the book. They beat Purdue 71-70 in overtime in Bloomington. Steve Alford was unbelievable in saving that game. And Knight came in and said, you know, it was a beautiful day today, so I think I'm just going to go prepare for a hunting trip for tomorrow morning. Thanks for coming, guys. And as we're walking down the hall back to his locker room, and I said, Bob, why would you do that? You know, why? Because I'm thinking Steve Alford should be getting all sorts of glory, but he closed the locker room. And I said, why would you do that? He says, just a little victory for me. And that was Bob. He was still trying to prove, you know, that his firing was wrong and that Miles Brand had done him wrong by firing him. After Miles Brand was dead.
I know.
He was still trying to win.
There you go. Gotta love it. John Feinstein, congrats on the book. Thank you, man.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me, John.
You bet. There he goes. John Feinstein, the book is called The Ancient Eight, College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. Stephen, do we have a copy of this book to give away to a lucky listener?
We do. I have the book right here. I'm looking at it. I'm holding it right now. We have it in our studio. Right.
Can you pound it on the desk? Because it's a heavy book,
yes.
Isn't it? There it is. Would you like this book in your hot little hands? 503-417-7575. Judah Newby standing by. Caller number 4 sounds good to me. Caller number 4, you'll get a copy of Feinstein's book. Leave it here. We got Punch It Audio still ahead.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.